He's leaving for Moscow in an hour.
She barely registered Lyndhurst's presence. A stone-faced woman in her 50s, she was many years in the CEO's service and effectively had more authority than any two senior vice presidents put together. But Lyndhurst had more authority than 10. He pushed his way through the towering double doors.
Garrett!
She called after him. He ignored her and proceeded into the CEO's cavernous office at a quick pace. The tanned, pampered face of Russell Van Owen Jr., CEO and chairman of Leland Equity Group, looked up from reading a letter. He scowled.
Damn it, Garrett, make an appointment!
Garrett heard the doors close behind him, and he took a deep breath.
This can't wait.
Then just pick up the phone, for Christ's sakes!
We need a face-to-face.
Van Owen regarded him like a statue would a pigeon. Van Owen had that obsessively groomed look of the fabulously rich, as though his head were the grounds of Augusta National and 100 groundskeepers swarmed over it each morning. The ring of white hair sweeping around the back of his head was perfectly manicured like a green. The pores of his skin were flawless. His suit, masterfully tailored to make his husky form look manly and authoritative. Yet, for all his obvious fastidiousness, Van Owen did not look soft. Stocky, intimidating, with a presence that projected itself without having to speak, his eyes scanned a room like twin 50-caliber machine guns. And he had an almost mystical authority in this office, with its bank of tall windows overlooking downtown Chicago and Lake Michigan beyond. This was a fabled seat of power, overlooking the length and breadth of the land. Lyndhurst proceeded toward Van Owen's massive teak wood desk, still 30 feet away.
We have a major problem, Russ.
Van Owen still held a letter in one hand, glaring over his reading glasses. He reluctantly dropped the letter on his otherwise empty desk and removed his glasses.
When you say we, I take that to mean you.
He glanced at his massive watch, tugging a cuff-linked sleeve up to see the face.
I'm heading out to the airfield any minute.
There wasn't any time to finesse it.
We've lost administrator rights to our network.
This did not have the impact Lyndhurst hoped. Van Owen shrugged slightly and now looked greatly irritated.
So what the hell do you want me to do about it? You're the CIO. Ride your people until they fix it. Jesus, Garrett!
Lyndhurst sat down in one of the uncomfortable leather chairs, pulling it right up to the desk. He leaned in close, still clutching the rolled magazine.
Russ, listen to me. We don't have any control over our databases.
My response is the same. Now would you let me read this letter, please?
We are under attack!
That got Van Owen's attention.
Attack?
Attack. All offices worldwide. Look, I get in this morning and I have phone calls from 6 division heads telling me they can't log on as admins to our servers. They think it's a layoff and that they've been shut out on purpose.
Were they?
Not by us. Turns out, no one can get an admin logon. Not even here in the main office. All systems rebooted last night, and somehow somebody took over our network. We have only limited rights to it.
Now Van Owen looked really angry. He pounded his fist on the desk.
Jesus Christ, Lyndhurst! Why the hell wasn't I told about this sooner? Our clients must be screaming bloody murder!
Hold on a second. Our websites are up, and we can access data no problem. So can our clients. We can even change data, so no one outside Leland knows yet.
Confused and getting angrier by the moment, Van Owen gestured.
So what's the problem?
The problem is that we can't back up, restore, or change our servers. We can't even export data.
I may not know much about this stuff, Lyndhurst, but I do know we spent $30 million on backup systems. Surely you can take a backup copy and restore it.
That's just it. Our backup SANs are toast. Our off-site replication trashed. The log files were faked. We have no backups newer than 4 months ago.
Van Owen squinted at him.
How is that possible? I spent $47 million on IT last year alone. We were supposed to have the most advanced network security money can buy. You assured me of that. You assured the board of that. That's why we hired you.
I don't think our systems were breached. Not from the outside. I think it's an inside job.
Call the FBI.
We can't do that.
The hell we can't?
Understand this, Russ. They can flush our entire network down the toilet with a single keystroke. From just about anywhere in the world, this company is hanging by a thread.
The room got deathly quiet. Still staring, Van Owen spoke with the sort of calm voice that usually precedes violence.
Explain this to me, Garrett.
It gets much worse.
Worse? How the hell can it get any worse?
Watch.
Garrett motioned for Van Owen to follow him. Van Owen's office was huge, with double-height ceiling and windows. Several sets of sofas and leather chairs were placed about the room, with a wide plasma-screen television on the far end and a conference table nearby, encircled by chairs. The place was easily a couple thousand square feet. Van Owen reluctantly got up from his desk and followed Lyndhurst to the plasma screen. Lyndhurst was already fiddling with a remote he had picked up from the credenza there. Van Owen settled into a conference table chair.
I'll see that the people behind this go to federal prison for the rest of their lives.
I don't think so.
What the hell's that supposed to mean?
You'll see in a moment.
Lyndhurst gestured to the plasma screen.
Have you used this video conferencing system yet? It costs $70,000.
God damn it, Lyndhurst!
Okay. Look, this system is jacked into our corporate network. I put something out there that I want you to see.
Lyndhurst used the remote to navigate to an intranet webpage, which filled the screen.
I found an email in my inbox this morning. It was from the system administrator, the new system administrator, the person who took my rights away. That email contained a hyperlink, which I copied to this network share. He navigated to another page and clicked a hyperlink. Here is what I saw.
Van Owen looked impatiently at the screen. The 70-inch plasma monitor suddenly went black, and after a few moments, a whooshing sound effect escorted a whirling logo into the center of the screen. It was a stylized emblem of the words, Demon Industries LLC. A professional-sounding female announcer came on, along with cavorting corporate music. It was like an infomercial or network marketing video. Her voice was cheerful.
Welcome to the Demon Industries family of companies. In just a moment, you'll hear some of the exciting new opportunities available to you in this fast-growing global organization, an organization to which your company now belongs. But first, a word from our founder.
Van Owen frowned.
Lyndhurst?
Shh! He pointed.
The screen faded in on a man in his mid-30s. He was sitting in a chair next to a fireplace. The chirpy corporate muzak continued in the background. Words appeared at the bottom of the screen. Matthew A. Sobel, Ph.D., Chairman and CEO, Demon Industries, LLC. Sobel nodded once in dour greeting. Lyndhurst hit the pause button on the remote. Sobel froze in mid-nod.
That's him.
That's who?
Van Owen squinted at the words on screen. He turned back to Lyndhurst.
Never heard of him. Is this the person who broke into our network?
Yes.
Call the FBI.
Won't do any good, Russ. Matthew Sobel's dead.
Lyndhurst handed the rolled magazine to Van Owen. Van Owen just glanced down at it, then with some reluctance took it. He unrolled it and moved it to arm's length so he could see the cover with his myopic eyes. The same Matthew Sobel was on the cover of the magazine. It was 8 months old. The headline read, Murderer from Beyond the Grave.
That guy?
Van Owen tossed the magazine onto the nearby conference table.
That was a hoax!
He motioned to the plasma screen.
So is this. My kid at USC could probably make this video on his PowerBook.
Russ, someone managed a coordinated global attack that not only stole rights to our worldwide network, but they did it months ago without raising a single alarm. They didn't leave a trace. Matthew Sobel was one of the few people who could have pulled it off.
You're frighteningly gullible. Jesus, some hackers got into our network and they're trying to put one over on you. Call the FBI.
Russ, no one faked this video. If you listen to him, you'll see what I mean.
Lyndhurst released the pause button. Matthew Sobel came back to life on screen. The infomercial music faded as he finished his nod.
By now, you're beginning to realize that you no longer control your network and that your backups are damaged beyond repair. I am now an integral part of your organization and have been for several months. Let me assure you that your corporate data is safe and that sufficient backups exist off-site to provide seamless protection in the event of a natural disaster or other calamity. Before I continue, let me caution you to watch this video in its entirety before contacting your local or federal authorities. This recording contains important information that may affect your decision to involve those entities in this situation.
A light musical jingle accompanied a twirling inset picture that spun to a stop alongside Sobel's head. It was a video of Sobel's mansion roaring in flames. Sobel smiled pleasantly.
As you can see, involving the authorities is no guarantee of your safety, although they would certainly be willing to try again at your location.
The inset video image transitioned to a collection of quivering question marks. Sobel looked intently into the camera.
But you're probably wondering just how you got yourselves into this situation. To answer that question, surprisingly, we need to go back hundreds of millions of years to the very origins of life on Earth.
The question marks expanded to fill the screen and faded away as the entire screen dissolved to an image of primordial Earth. It was a 3D computer animation of the ancient seas teeming with exotic life, razor-toothed fish with whip-like proboscis, and flitting schools of tiny translucent organisms. Vangelis music rose on the surround sound speakers. Sobel narrated.
Let me tell you the story of the most successful organism of all time. This is the story of the parasite.
On screen, a large, particularly evil-looking fish with twin rows of splayed fangs and a spiked dorsal array glided into view. Just then, a small organism swam for the area just behind the enormous fish's gills, where it latched on, unnoticed. A dozen others followed it and also latched on. Sobel spoke.
Early on, evolution branched into two distinct paths: independent organisms, those that exist in the natural world, and parasites, organisms that live on other organisms. And it was, by far, the parasites that proved the more successful of the two branches. Today, for every independent organism in nature, there exist three parasites.
The computer animation transitioned from one eon to the next, from amphibian to reptilian to mammalian, with parasites continuing to evolve along with their hosts, infesting some species, driving them to extinction, while other species evolved means to keep them at bay, at least for a time.
These two strains of evolution have been locked in a primordial arms race, constantly evolving to best each other for supremacy of this planet. As parasites evolve to perfect their systems against a species of host, the host evolves to evade their attack. Scientists call this theory of an eternal genetic struggle the Red Queen Hypothesis, a name taken from Lewis Carroll's Through the Looking Glass.
On screen, the image suddenly changed to an animation of Alice in Wonderland, with the Red Queen running along a hedgerow maze and looking toward little Alice, who struggled to keep up. She was saying,
"Now here, you see, it takes all the running you can do to keep in the same place."
The screen changed to a video of a small pond with snails moving through the mud.
Animal behavior has evolved to battle parasites. In fact, we have parasites to thank for the existence of sex. Sex is a costly and time-consuming method of reproduction. Experiments have shown that, in absence of parasites, species evolve toward parthenogenesis, or cloning, as the reproductive method of choice. In parthenogenesis, each individual is able to self-replicate, but this produces almost no genetic variation. In the presence of parasites, cloning, while more energy efficient, is not a viable reproductive strategy. It presents a stationary genetic target to parasites who, once introduced into such a system, will quickly dominate it.
The screen changed to an animated diagram of twin sets of human DNA strands, which moved as Sobel spoke.
Sexual reproduction exists solely as a means to defeat parasites. By mixing male and female genes, sex produces offspring not exactly like either the male or female, making each generation different from the last, and presenting a moving target to intruders intent on compromising this system. Even with this variation, parasites continue to pose a threat.
The screen changed to color film footage of native villages with truly hideous parasitic infestations. Children with bulging, worm-filled bellies, malaria victims.
And parasitism evolves and moves through any system, not just living things. The less variation there is in a system, the more readily parasites will evolve to infest it.
The screen showed foodborne illness outbreaks, images of fast food restaurants. The camera panned to reveal identical restaurants running down the sides of each street in Dallas, in Denver, in Orlando, in Phoenix.
Perfect replication is the enemy of any robust system.
Then images of identical rows of computers in a data center, all running the same operating system.
Lacking a central nervous system, much less a brain, the parasite is a simple system designed to compromise a very specific target host. The more uniform the host, the more effective the infestation.
The screen changed to a video image of a hermit crab moving along the sandy ocean bottom. The camera followed it as Sobel spoke.
But if they're so successful, why haven't parasites taken over the world? The answer is simple. They have. We just haven't noticed. That's because successful parasites don't kill us. They become part of us, making us perform all the work to keep them alive and help them reproduce.
The crab scuttled toward its hole.
Saculina is a parasite that infests saltwater crabs. It burrows into their flesh and extends tendrils into the crab's bloodstream and brain. It chemically castrates the crab and becomes its new brain, controlling it like a zombie.
The screen then showed an image of a saculina-infested crab with the bulging sac of the parasite filling its abdomen.
It compels the crab to raise the parasite's young. It enslaves it.
The screen changed to a close-up computer animation. It was a double helix of DNA, with each set of genes showing clearly as rungs on the genetic ladder. The perspective moved along the length of the helix.
And so have thousands of parasites done with us. After tens of thousands of years, a parasite becomes so much a part of us that they evolve into sections of our DNA.
Certain sections of the DNA highlighted one after another.
They have so enslaved us that we believe we're reproducing ourselves, when in reality, we're reproducing hidden others within us. 40% of our genetic code consists of these useless segments of DNA, sections that serve no useful purpose to us. Nearly half the human genome is just the ghostly remnant of parasites.
The images of DNA dissolved back to Sobel, sitting in his armchair by the fireplace.
By now, you've figured out that my demon is your parasite, and that you are hopelessly infected. The demon will sip your corporate blood, but it will not be fatal. More importantly, the demon will keep other parasites out of your system, strengthening your immunity and ensuring that the corporate host continues to survive.
The fireplace background dissolved, and Sobel now appeared on a black background. He was more serious.
But know this. My demon has enlisted humans within your organization. These are hijacked cells in the corporate organism, people who thirst for more power. That's how the demon got in. You have no way of knowing who is responsible. My demon can teach almost anyone to defeat network security, especially from an existing network account. The reality is that my demon now controls your global IT function. Your business will operate as before, and no one will suspect that there is anything unusual going on, except that perhaps your systems will run better than they did when you were responsible for them. Your natural inclination will be to resist this indignity, of course, and so you will be tempted to contact the authorities. That is your choice. Although, the moment my demon detects such contact, it will wipe your company's data off the face of the earth. And don't even think of replicating your databases from scratch with paper files. Remember that my demon has agents among your staff. You can hide nothing from it. If you start polygraphing, or if you lay off everyone, the demon will destroy your company. If you attempt to infiltrate an undercover operative into your IT department, it will destroy your company. If you attempt to exert control over your IT department, or to create a new one, it will destroy your company. In short, if you attempt to do anything other than ignore my demon, it will destroy your company. As a financial enterprise wholly reliant upon the trust of your clients, the loss of all your clients' data will bring ruin upon you. As for insurance, the demon will annihilate you whenever you reappear, and it will never stop until both your company and you as individual officers are financially destroyed. Being a non-sentient, narrow AI construct, the demon doesn't give a damn what choice you make. It's as dumb as Saculina.
A pause.
And just as effective.
The fireplace background reappeared, and Sobel smiled again.
I hope you and my demon can peacefully coexist. I think you'll find that, as the years roll by, you'll be glad indeed that you didn't try to defy it, especially as you take market share from those companies that did defy it. So please, carefully consider your options. And just remember, no matter what you choose, you serve a crucial role in evolution, even if it's just as food for the survivors. Thanks for watching.
Sobel waved pleasantly as the saccharine corporate muzak came up, accompanied by fanatical applause. Credits rolled by impossibly fast. The female announcer returned.
Don't touch that dial. In a few moments, you'll have a chance to see how you can avoid destruction at the hands of the demon. And be sure to take the demon quiz.
Lyndhurst hit the stop button, and the screen went black. Van Owen sat there like someone who had just been through electroshock therapy. His mouth hung open for several moments before he turned dull eyes toward Lyndhurst.
It's really Sobel.
That's what I was trying to tell you. There were a few moments of silence.
We have to call the authorities.
If we call the FBI and word gets out about this, our investors will bail and sue.
Van Owen nodded. He suddenly frowned as if remembering to be angry.
Damn it, Lyndhurst! What kind of an organization are you running down there? Your systems may be responsible for the destruction of this company. A company with a century of history. When the shit hits the fan, I'm going to point the finger of blame squarely at you, where it belongs, and you can count on that.
Lyndhurst looked darkly at Van Owen.
That's a touching sentiment, but I seem to remember it was you who told me to cut IT headcount by half and slash the benefits of the rest. That left us with plenty of disgruntled people in our midst.
You took your bonus, if I remember.
Look, let's not turn this into a blame-storming session. There'll be plenty of time for that if we fail. In the meantime, we should focus on what we're going to do.
You mean what you're going to do. I'm going to Moscow to maintain the appearance of normalcy. But I want a report in my inbox by the time I land, detailing precisely what you intend to do to solve this problem.
No email. Our systems are compromised. The phones, too. They're voice over IP. The signals go over the computer network. We'll need to use our personal cell phones and handwritten correspondence only. Nothing enters a computer concerning this situation. Not a single typed character. Not even a scheduled meeting between us. Nothing. Otherwise, they'll know what we're up to.
Van Owen was slightly taken aback.
You're serious?
Russ, you might not have noticed, but this entire organization is stitched together with computer networks. You can't enter the parking garage without producing half a dozen records in some database. Sobel says he has people on our staff, and they no doubt can see everything we're doing.
If you ask me, this is simple. We shut off everything and go back to using pens, paper, and phones. Lay off all these IT bastards. We'll see how they like that.
Lyndhurst took a deep breath to keep from losing his temper. He heard this suggestion from time to time from men of Van Owen's generation. Lyndhurst chose his words carefully.
Russ, our competitors deliver market information in seconds to their clients, and we need to also. That doesn't even begin to cover the fact that we need information just as much, if not more, than our clients in order to make a profit. If you turn off these systems, you may as well lock the doors.
Van Owen was already nodding.
You're right. Of course you're right. But damn it, I knew this would happen one of these days with these goddamn computers.
Lyndhurst let this Nostradamus-like post-dated prediction go uncontested.
Let's be explicit, then. You go about your normal schedule, I'll see what I can do about the problem, and when you return, we meet first thing, in person and off-site.
Are you sure we shouldn't simply call the authorities?
Look, even if we decide to contact them, the more we know about what's really going on, the better. We're only talking about a few days more, and this thing has been inside us for months.
Remember, the slightest hint that there's trouble, and this thing is liable to pull the plug on all our data.
But would it really do that? Then it would get nothing.
This isn't a person, Russ. It's a logic tree. That's like wondering if a computer has the courage to put the letter D on screen if you tap the D key. I suspect that a few employees have handed over control to the demon. I'm hoping I can quietly discover who and convince them to change sides again.
Van Owen waved that topic aside.
I don't want to hear details. Just tell me when you've solved it. Now get out of here. I've got to get ready to leave.
Lyndhurst put the remote down. He moved to leave, but then turned back toward Van Owen.
What's in Moscow, Russ?
Van Owen scowled.
What?
I'm just curious why you're heading to Moscow. Are we setting up a branch office there?
Van Owen pointed to the door.
Go solve this problem, will you please?
Lyndhurst regarded Van Owen for a moment more. He knew the old man was hiding something from him. He just didn't know what. But for once, Lyndhurst had a few cards up his own sleeve. Cards that the old man's generation didn't even know existed.
Chapter 32. Message. Black screen. Suddenly, a gleaming chrome logo hissed in from the left while ultra-pasteurized techno music thumped in over the title. News to America. The title twirled into infinity as inset video images crisscrossed the screen and the music built in tempo. Angie Anderson pushing a microphone at a businessman covering his face. Anderson helping a handicapped child take her first steps on artificial limbs. Anderson typing feverishly at a laptop keyboard in the open air while columns of black smoke towered over a city skyline behind her. Fast cuts following fast cuts, half a second each. The human brain had to scramble to identify the image, determine whether it presented a threat, and just barely resolved it in time for the next image. Anderson standing, arms akimbo, glowering at the camera in the middle of Times Square, while her name slid into place beneath her beltline. The music stopped cold. The screen flipped immediately to black. A color photograph of a small child faded in, a boy smiling into his birthday cake surrounded by friends. Anderson's voice rose.
Peter Andrew Seebeck was born in Simi Valley, California, only son to Marilyn and Wayne Seebeck. He was their ray of hope after the loss of their first daughter to leukemia 2 years earlier. Outgoing, well-liked, Peter was a model child.
Another picture resolved over the first. It showed Seebeck in a high school football uniform, holding his helmet on his knee, once again smiling.
Peter appeared to have the perfect life. But his early promise was cut short when he fathered a child at the age of 16 with Laura Dietrich, a girl he'd known only a short while. Within a year, they married. Friends described it as a cold marriage, devoid of tenderness. Yet, to all outward appearances, Pete Seebeck was still a model citizen. He joined the Ventura County Sheriff's Department at age 21, took night classes to earn a bachelor's degree in criminal justice, and rose quickly, becoming a twice-decorated officer and later a sergeant of detectives. To his fellow deputies, he was a no-nonsense officer and a family man, a well-respected citizen of Thousand Oaks, California, the safest city in America.
Chilling music rose. The image changed to a still photo of a menacing Seebeck being escorted in handcuffs, his face a blur of fast-moving rage, lashing out at reporters. It was the type of iconic photograph that made careers, a symbol of the times, a photo of the year.
But this facade concealed a darker side. Peter Seebeck, convicted mass murderer, 9 of his victims federal officers. Another victim, a young colleague who trusted and admired him. Conspirator, embezzler, adulterer, sex and drug addict. What drives seemingly normal people to commit heinous acts? Is it anger, greed, or does evil really exist? Can it possess you? Tonight, we'll find out as I interview Peter Seebeck live from Lompoc Federal Prison. This is News to America.
The techno music rose again. A title appeared. Seebeck on Death Row. The screen resolved on Anderson, sitting erect and alert in medium close-up. She looked businesslike yet sexy in a dark Chanel suit. Her makeup was perfect in the warm glow of camera lights. The lighting had to be done carefully so as not to reflect harshly off the bulletproof glass partition, beyond which sat Detective Sergeant Peter Seebeck, the most hated man in America. She had helped to make that a reality. Seebeck stared from behind the small intercom microphone in the prison visitation cell. The studio provided a better sound system for this interview, and a smaller microphone was clipped onto Seebeck's khaki prison jumpsuit. One quarter of all households were anticipated to tune in. Everything was in place, and after a quick smile, Anderson began.
"I must confess, Detective Seebeck, I'm surprised you agreed to this interview. I'm the person most responsible for your capture and conviction."
Seebeck regarded her coolly. "I agreed for my own reasons, not yours."
"So you still claim innocence?"
"I am innocent."
"How do you explain the substantial evidence against you?"
"It was manufactured by Matthew Sobel. He stole my identity years ago."
"So you still claim that Sobel's demon is real, even though all efforts to discover such a thing have come up empty?"
Seebeck tried to keep his cool. "The government wants people to believe the demon is a hoax. They think it takes them off the hook."
Anderson shook her head sadly. "Detective, you've already admitted your relationship with Cheryl Lanthrop. Or did Sobel fake that, too?"
"He facilitated it. It was designed to impugn my character."
"But you've been quoted saying..."
"I've been incorrectly quoted, most of the time by you. And there's no appeal to the court of public opinion, is there? But I guess you know that."
"Then this is a conspiracy against you. Everyone from the media to the police and Sobel himself have all conspired to frame you for these murders. You're completely innocent."
"I'm guilty of this much. Being a bad husband and a worse father. I'm guilty of having an affair and of being too egotistical to realize I was being set up."
"Please forgive me, Detective, but that sounds far-fetched."
"Yes, that's the whole point. It was designed to be far-fetched."
"Designed by Sobel?"
"Yes."
"So you're asking everyone to believe you instead of the facts. We're to believe that Sobel went to Herculean lengths to frame you, spending not just millions but tens of millions of dollars in the effort?"
"I'm not asking anyone to believe anything. To be honest, even I wouldn't believe me."
"So you don't blame anyone?"
Seebeck stared hard at her. "Oh, I blame some people, but their time will come."
"That sounds like a threat. Do you believe the American public will be sympathetic toward threats?"
"I'm not here to talk to the American public."
"Then who are you here to talk to?"
"The demon."
"The demon?"
Anderson was taken aback.
"The demon doesn't exist, Sergeant."
"You and I both know that isn't true."
Anderson shrugged blissfully. "No, I don't know that."
"You're real proud of yourself, aren't you, Angie? Famous and rich, isn't that what the demon promised you? And all you had to do was sell your soul, if you ever had one."
"I didn't come here to be insulted, ex-detective. Why don't you tell us your side of the demon hoax instead? Help us understand your point of view."
"Keep them entertained, Angie. Keep them busy and distracted. That's your purpose, isn't it?" "I see that now. Be careful, because I'm starting to understand Sobel. Maybe even better than you. I've had plenty of time to think in here. Why did Sobel warn me?"
"Sobel warned you? How did he warn you?"
"At his funeral, he said he would destroy me. Those were his exact words, and that's exactly what he did. He destroyed everything that once defined me. It doesn't make sense that he would warn me. Unless he had further plans for me."
"So he's your friend now. Does that idea comfort you?"
Seebeck looked her straight in the eye. "Fuck you."
Anderson clenched her jaw angrily for a moment. Then a pleasant smile spread across her face. "We have a time delay, Detective, but please watch your language. This is a family show."
I understand what Sobel meant now.
Well, you're running out of time to solve the case, Sergeant. If the Supreme Court refuses your appeal, you're scheduled to die by lethal injection. You must be impressed by the unusually swift hand of justice.
Seebeck contemplated it calmly.
It is unusual, isn't it?
Perhaps it was the murder of those federal officers.
Why are you helping this thing? Do you think it will ever let you go? Do you think you will ever be free?
Anderson ignored him.
You're undergoing psychiatric treatment. Is that going well?
I'm through talking to you. I came here to send a message to the demon.
Well, you'd better hope it watches television, detective.
Seebeck looked directly into the camera.
At Sobel's funeral, he phoned me. He said that I had to accept the demon, that in the months before my death I had to invoke it. And although it will make me sound more insane than ever, my message is this. I, Peter Seebeck, accept the demon, and I am ready to face the consequences.
Seebeck turned to the prison guards and federal officials standing behind Anderson.
That message needs to get out. She'll try to cut it from the interview. And when she does, you'll know she's afraid. You'll know she's in collusion with the demon. If you think I'm a nutcase, then that's all the more reason to get my message out there. It proves your case against me. It condemns me.
Anderson watched grimly from beyond the bulletproof partition.
Sergeant, there is no demon, but I'll be happy to pass along the message.
Seebeck pointed at her.
You and I will meet again.
Anderson felt strangely exhilarated. Seebeck was sexy when he was pissed off. And God, did this guy have balls. He was going to die, but he was going down swinging. She motioned to stop rolling camera, then locked eyes with Seebeck.
I'll convey the message, have no doubt.
She had a direct line after all. And word from the demon was that Seebeck must die. Chapter 33. Response.
Yahoo.com News. Seebeck's macabre message. In a live interview with Angie Anderson Friday at Lompoc Federal Prison, Peter Seebeck, the ex-Ventura County Sheriff's Detective convicted in last year's demon hoax, directed a bizarre message to the late Matthew Sobel. My message is this. I, Peter Seebeck, accept the demon. Legal experts doubt a belated insanity defense will have any effect on Seebeck's pending federal appeal.
In a dark storage room in a nondescript export company in the Huangsun industrial zone of Dongguan City, China, a low-end server stood wedged between stacks of toner cartridges and counterfeit software packages. A long-forgotten Cat 5 cable ran from the back of the machine, snaking behind towering boxes containing yet more boxes, and terminated in a fast Ethernet jack just to the left of an overloaded electrical outlet, both lost to sight behind cases of Communist Party propaganda pamphlets, printed specifically for use as props in Western-themed restaurants. The Ethernet jack ran, in turn, to the company network, which in turn led to the corporate web server, which in turn led to the world. The computer fan hummed as the machine used RSS to scan the contents of the same 400 websites every minute. And at exactly 17 minutes past midnight Greenwich Mean Time, the machine stopped scanning.
The computer's hard drive whined to life and started clicking feverishly, sending out packets to hundreds of IP addresses before committing digital suicide by erasing itself.
Another demon event had been triggered. Part 3. 6 months later. Chapter 34. Saculina.
What the hell is going on with these numbers, people?
Russell Van Owen Jr. looked up from the P&Ls in his executive financial summary. He frowned down the burled walnut table running the length of his paneled corporate boardroom. The familiar faces of 24 Leland board members and senior executives stared back. The faces were all the more familiar because he served on their boards, too.
I've got 7 divisions running over budget with only IT on target. What the hell is going on here? Why didn't I receive any guidance on this?
Harris Breaknooch, the CFO, shook his head slowly.
Russ, let me stop you right there. These numbers are wrong.
Wrong? How are they wrong?
Wrong as in not right. Look.
He slid an open binder across the table. Other execs passed it on to Van Owen.
This is what we're getting from our offline systems.
What the hell, Harris? You mean spreadsheets? You're passing me spreadsheets? Why did I spend $50 million on a real-time enterprise accounting system if we can just use spreadsheets?
The accounting system is wrong. Things are being assigned to the wrong cost centers.
Forget cost centers. We're $60 million over budget this month. It doesn't matter how you move the shells around, you'll still have the same number of shells.
Yes, but numbers aren't being assigned to the correct cost centers.
Well, then your people are screwing up the entries.
They're not screwing up the data entry, Russ. We're not $60 million off the mark this month from keying errors. I had my people start recording these problems because...
Why is this the first I've heard about it?
Breaknooch stopped, girded himself, then continued.
You haven't heard about it because Lyndhurst told me they'd fix it. It's under his purview, not mine. IT runs the accounting system.
Milton Hewitt, the executive VP of the brokerage division, leaned forward.
He's right, Russ. Our cost centers are under budget this period, and we exceeded our revenue targets. But these reports coming out of the accounting system are all screwed up.
Several others voiced their agreement. Van Owen threw up his hands.
Jesus H. fucking Christ!
He looked around.
Lyndhurst! Where's Lyndhurst?
Everyone glanced around theatrically. They knew he wasn't present. Again. Van Owen dropped his leather folio onto the table with a bang.
God damn it, Janice!
The disembodied voice of Van Owen's secretary carried over from somewhere among the chairs lining the wall.
Yes, Russ.
Is Lyndhurst in today? Has he been reminded of this meeting? The monthly board meeting?
I checked his calendar. He should be in. I phoned him this morning.
And what did he say?
Voicemail. I left 3 messages, and I emailed him.
God damn it! Did you call his cell phone?
Voicemail. Voicemail on his home and car phones, too.
Chris Hempers, the COO, raised a finger to call attention to himself.
I flew to the trade summit in Montreal with him yesterday.
He left town with this going on? Is he back in the office?
Hempers nodded.
We took one of the Gulf Streams, Ludovic, Ryans, Lyndhurst, and I.
Several voices spoke simultaneously.
He's here.
They smelled blood, a career being cut short, and the possibility of a high-level opening for a friend or relation. Van Owen was building a head of steam, for which he was justifiably famous.
Well, now I know why he doesn't want to be here. His folks have screwed up the accounting system and they hid the problems from me. I hope Lyndhurst has a drug problem, because that's about the only thing that would explain this. Janice, get him on this phone right now!
He pointed to the cutting-edge speakerphone in the center of the tabletop.
I just tried his line again, Russ. Voicemail.
God damn it!
Van Owen glanced around.
Board members, please carry on with the agenda. Ryans, you preside. I'm going to retrieve our Mr. Lyndhurst, and we'll get to the bottom of this right now.
Like most companies, Leland Equity Group maintained a data center where no window offices would be lost, in the basement. Thus, Leland's 50-story office tower had several temperature-controlled sub-basements linked directly into the fiber-optic network running beneath the streets of downtown Chicago. From the sub-basement, the IT department's tendrils spread to every corner of the building, snaking up all 50 floors through trunk lines that fanned out on each floor to tap every employee individually. As Van Owen took the separate bank of elevators leading into the basement, he realized how like the Saculina parasite the IT department was. And lately, it had been growing, without authorization.
Lyndhurst said he'd taken care of this.
Months ago, Lyndhurst had moved from his corner office on the 49th floor into the windowless bowels of the building. It was an unprecedented gesture of hands-on management. To Van Owen's delight, Lyndhurst presided over a 2-month bloodbath of IT layoffs, purging the department of questionable individuals, cleansing the global organization and hiring new people who had no doubt where their loyalties should lie. And Leland Equity not only remained, it thrived like never before. The would-be demon was stopped. Lyndhurst had succeeded, and not a word about their little difficulty had made it into the press. The problem was gone. But now, something frightening was happening. The accounting system was wrong. They were a private equity house, for Christ's sakes. They had to know how to add and subtract numbers. Van Owen was starting to wonder whether Lyndhurst had manufactured this whole threat. Was he that ambitious? Was he that clever? No way, he thought. Lyndhurst certainly had his little fiefdom locked down tight now. Even Van Owen had to order lobby security to enter a code into the keypad in the elevators to get them to move down into the sub-basement. The place was like a missile silo. Perhaps Lyndhurst was getting too distant from upper management. Perhaps it was time to pull him back into the executive suite, or to fire him. Van Owen pondered this as the elevator doors opened onto a long, featureless white hallway on level B2. Uncharacteristically, the hall ran straight ahead, no right or left. Van Owen had never been down here. The corridor stretched for what looked like 100 feet or more. It had the plastic smell of new construction. Not a sign, a receptionist desk, or anything. He hesitated a moment. But Van Owen still felt a bit of anger, so he strode out and down the hall, his expensive shoes clacking on the black tile floor.
What the hell kind of place is this?
He tried to recall any descriptions of the IT department by other executives, but came up empty. He kept clicking down the interminable hallway. There were no doors. He squinted ahead, but the hallway somehow seemed to disappear in a dim blackness. Surely he should be able to see the end of it. He glanced back at the elevator door. It was nearly 100 feet back. Could they have mistakenly sent him to the storage floor? He turned front again and peered into the distance.
Damnedest thing.
Then, something impossible happened. A female voice spoke to him from the air 6 inches in front of his face.
Why have you come here?
Van Owen jumped back 3 feet and nearly fell on his ass. His gasp echoed down the hallway in both directions. He took a moment to catch his breath. He held his chest, still gasping for air. Was he having a coronary? The voice spoke again from that spot in midair.
You were commanded to stay out of this place.
It was like a ghost. But it was a computer voice, wasn't it? He could just get a hint of artificiality in it. British. Leland had a sophisticated voice response system on their customer service phone lines. Lyndhurst had demonstrated it to the board last year. It reduced call center costs by 90%. It was cheaper than India. But it didn't speak in midair. This was just a trick. Van Owen was getting his wits back, and his anger. This prank was way out of line.
Lyndhurst! Get me Lyndhurst, goddammit!
Van Owen's voice echoed. I will not be treated this way!
Quiet!
The word was so loud it ripped the fabric of the air around him. It was a physical presence that bowled him over and sent him sprawling backward where he lay in the hallway, dazed. His ears were ringing, his eyes watering. It was possibly the loudest sound he'd ever experienced. He felt a trickle running from his right nostril, and he dabbed a hand up, coming back with blood.
Jesus!
He pulled a silk handkerchief from his pocket and held it to his face. His hands were trembling uncontrollably. It quickly swelled to panic. He crawled on his hands and knees, then got to his feet and started running back the way he came. He hadn't actually run in years, but adrenaline carried him the 100 feet back to the elevator. He arrived panting and nearly hysterical. But there was no button. The elevator doors were like brushed steel gates. This was impossible. There was no call button. How could there be no button? The voice was right beside his ear, as if he hadn't moved. He could feel the air vibrating.
Your company belongs to me now. Your divisions will obey their new budgets. If any division heads object, send them to me.
Van Owen's hands were still trembling. It was Lyndhurst. Lyndhurst was, or someone was behind this. It was extortion. This was a scare tactic.
Of course. You doubt that I am real. You doubt that I am Sobel's demon. And you doubt that my power spans the globe. I will prove to you the extent of my reach.
There was a pause.
I just caused you millions of dollars in personal losses. Losses across your portfolio and unrelated to this company. You will either learn from this event or I will seize your personal wealth and eject you from this company. I will be watching you. Do you understand this final warning?
Van Owen stared at the air, still trembling, waiting for it to end.
Do you understand?
Yes! Yes! Yes!
He was covering his ears and face with the handkerchief, practically weeping. The elevator doors suddenly opened, and Van Owen fell inside. He scrambled on his hands and knees and curled up in the farthest corner. The voice spoke again, but from the hallway, as if it was standing there, seeing him off.
If you fight me, I will only hurt you more.
With that, the elevator doors slammed together with frightful force. The car began to ascend. Van Owen sat there shaking, blood running down his face. Van Owen spent the remainder of the afternoon in a daze in his corner office, receiving a parade of phone calls from his attorneys and brokers. Millions of dollars had disappeared from his dozens of brokerage and bank accounts. More worrisome were the missing funds in the half-dozen offshore holding companies and the 24 limited partnerships in which he held assets, some of which were secret even to his wife, much less people at Leland. All told, almost 10% of his wealth had disappeared in the blink of an eye. He had just lost $80 million at separate institutions, some of which he held under assumed names. As he sat there, still shaking, he suddenly realized the enormity of the monster that had just brushed past him. It was colossally huge. And as powerful as he had always felt, he felt insignificant before it. He was now an employee of Demon Industries, LLC.
Chapter 35, Cruel Calculus.
Reuters.com Business. Dow sinks 820 points on renewed cyber attacks. Network intrusions destroyed data at two publicly traded multinational corporations Wednesday, bringing the total to 6 cyber attacks in as many days and sending financial markets into freefall. The stocks of Veteros Financial, NYS Vido, and Ambergy International, NASDAQ AMRG, fell to pennies a share before trading was halted. Federal authorities and international police agencies claim cyber terrorists infiltrated company systems, destroying data and backup tapes. In a worrisome development in the war on terror, unnamed sources indicated that Islamic terrorists were likely to blame, possibly students educated in Western universities.
Ops Center 1 was the National Security Agency's mission control room. Dozens of plasma screens lined its walls, displaying real-time data from around the world in vibrant colors and vector graphics. There were color-coded diagrams of telecom, satellite, and internet traffic. Other screens displayed current satellite coverage zones, and still others showed the status of seabed acoustic sensors, missile launch monitors, the location of radar, radio, seismic, and microwave listening posts. The moderately sized room had a central control board, but individual workstations were arrayed around it in aisles. Each was manned by a specialist case officer. Latin America, the Middle East, the Terrorist Threat Interrogation Center, the Drug Interdiction Task Force, and on and on. Uniformed military personnel dominated the space. They were relatively young people for the most part, not the seasoned analysts who developed strategy, but the younger officers who worked in the world of operations monitoring the data feeds. They were the nerve endings of the United States. They were especially keyed up as they watched the large central screen and its digital world map. Hundreds of red dots on that map were scattered throughout North America, Europe, and Southeast Asia. And in this business, red dots meant trouble. Dr. Natalie Phillips stood behind the central control board operator. A 3-star general and the NSA's deputy director, Chris Fulbright, stood alongside her. Fulbright had the earnest, soft-spoken manner of a high school guidance counselor, but his mild demeanor masked steely-eyed pragmatism. Phillips knew that mild-mannered people did not rise to Mahogany Row. She gestured to the digital map filling the screen.
Approximately 3,800 corporate networks in 16 countries have been hijacked by an unknown entity. And these are just the ones we know about. We have good reason to believe the entity is Sobel's demon.
The general stared at the screen.
Sergeant, notify the Joint Chiefs. Inform them that we are under attack.
The board operator looked up.
Already taken care of, sir.
The general looked to Phillips again.
Where are the attacks coming from?
Phillips stared at the world map.
You mean, where did they come from, General? The battle is long over.
What the hell is she talking about?
Deputy Director Fulbright interceded.
She means these networks were compromised some time ago. We are only learning about it just now.
The General's nostrils flared. He looked darkly at Phillips.
How is it possible no one noticed these networks go down?
Because they didn't go down. They're still operating normally.
The General looked confused.
Phillips explained. Someone took them over, and they're running them as if they own them.
The General gestured to the screens.
Why wasn't this detected? Our systems should have sounded the alarm the moment anomalous IP traffic patterns occurred. Isn't that what the neural logic farm is for?
Phillips was calm.
It wasn't detected, General, because there were no anomalous traffic patterns to detect. The demon is not an internet worm or a network exploit. It doesn't hack systems. It hacks society.
The General looked again to Fulbright. Fulbright obliged.
Dr. Phillips discovered the backdoor in Sobel's video game some months ago, one that allowed users to enter secret maps and be exposed to the demon's recruitment efforts.
The General nodded impatiently.
So the demon recruited people to compromise these corporate networks on its behalf?
Yes, we believe it coordinated the activities of thousands of people who had no individual knowledge of each other.
The demon task force was supposed to detect and infiltrate these terror cells.
Phillips regarded the General with deliberate patience.
Our monitoring resulted in several dozen arrests, but the demon network is massively parallel. No one person or event is critical to its survival. It has no ringleaders and no central point of failure, and no central repository of logic. None of the demon's agents know anything more than a few seconds in advance, so informants have been useless. It also seems highly adept at detecting monitoring.
Forget arrests. What about infiltration?
We've been working with the Interagency Task Force, but progress has been slow. My people are not undercover operatives. They know far too many national secrets to be put at risk of capture. And the operatives who've been brought forward from Langley and Quantico are not expert enough in the lingo and culture of computer gaming or cryptography and IP network architecture, for that matter. A third of them are evangelicals with little or no experience in online gaming. Developing their skills will take time. We're painfully short of suitable recruits.
The General pounded his hand on a chair back in frustration.
God damn it, this thing is running circles around us.
He looked to Phillips again.
How does recruiting kids through video games translate into taking over corporate networks?
Phillips was looking at the big screen.
Because it didn't recruit kids. Have a look at the demographics of video game sales. The biggest market segment is young men aged 18 to 28.
Fulbright nodded.
IT workers.
Maybe.
She turned to them both.
It could be any mid to low level employee. Not necessarily an IT staffer. Their efforts would be augmented by a massively parallel cyber organism that coordinates the efforts of thousands of other people. And it can pay.
The General tried to wrap his head around it.
But why would employees want to destroy their own company? It doesn't make sense.
There are always disgruntled or greedy people. The demon most likely deals them in.
The General had murder in his eyes.
These terrorists need to be found and shot.
Careful. The demon has already destroyed 24 companies that disobeyed its instructions. Among the currently infected are several multi-billion dollar corporations, representing a cross-section of strategic industries. Energy, finance, high-tech, biotech, media, manufacturing, food, transportation. The targets were obviously selected to maximize economic and social disruption in the event of their collapse.
The General was starting to see the big picture.
This is no different from a strategic bombing campaign. This demon could gut the global economy. What are our options?
She sighed.
Before we knew the extent of the infection, we attempted to penetrate a couple of compromised networks,
But our intrusion attempts were detected and the target networks, and thus the companies themselves were destroyed by the demon in retribution. Wiretaps and surveillance of individual employees by the FBI resulted in similar retribution. Apparently, the demon does not hesitate to destroy the companies it has taken hostage. Further infiltration attempts have been put on hold until new strategies can be developed.
Doctor, I repeat, what are our options?
Phillips paused.
Right now, we have only one. Inform the public. Tell them what's happening.
That's crazy talk. The stock market would crash.
Fulbright pointed them to a side conference room and spoke softly.
Please, let's continue this discussion behind closed doors. Everyone here may be cleared top secret, but they all have retirement funds.
They entered a small conference room, and the deputy director closed the door behind them. The general glared at Phillips.
Doctor, what would informing the public accomplish other than to destroy the 401ks of millions of taxpayers?
Right now, Sobel has you exactly where he wants you. His demon can prey upon millions of unsuspecting people because we haven't warned anyone. At some point, the demon is going to show itself, and we'll lose all credibility with the public.
Look, announce its existence before you're forced to, and we'll have billions of allies to help us destroy it.
Fulbright shook his head.
It's not that simple, Doctor. A news headline announcing that the demon exists might trigger a demon event. Possibly the deletion of all data in these compromised networks. It could cause financial Armageddon. It could cripple the world economy and lead to widespread conflict, even thermonuclear war. We can't risk that possibility.
Phillips didn't blink.
That's an extreme conclusion.
Extreme conclusions are what I'm paid to come to.
Do you ever plan on telling the public?
We'll inform them after we've developed a countermeasure.
But that might be never.
He didn't say anything.
Sir?
Yes, Doctor.
If you don't intend to announce the existence of the demon, then I hope you're planning to intervene on behalf of Peter Seebeck.
The general looked to her.
The cop on death row?
His appeals are moving through the federal courts unusually fast. He's scheduled to die by lethal injection.
Fulbright didn't respond immediately.
I'll take that under advisement, Doctor.
You could fake his execution.
This might seem harsh, but Peter Seebeck must suffer the full penalty demanded by law, and the sooner, the better. Faking his execution would risk tipping our hand to the demon.
Sir, please.
Phillips, you yourself said that the demon has operatives in thousands of organizations. It could also have operatives in the penal system or law enforcement. So we must take the safe course. Seebeck is a casualty of this war, Doctor. You must put him out of your mind and concentrate on saving the lives and property of millions more Americans.
Phillips stared at him for a moment.
But surely we...
There is no but, Doctor. Please focus on your work.
She was about to speak again when the general leaned in.
Any word from John Ross?
Phillips was still distracted, but collected herself.
Not recently.
The general nodded.
There's a hacker we need in custody ASAP. All these hackers should be rounded up and shot.
She eyed the general.
I'm a hacker, General, and if it weren't for people like John Ross, we'd be in far worse shape than we are.